I don't know how many of you remember last week in Psalm 1, but I hope quite a few of you have taken the challenge to memorize the verses as we go through them. I want to encourage you, if you haven't started it, to start. Start today. Don't worry about last week's if you didn't do it. But last week's a good one to start with. But if you didn't start, start today, because I really think that the verses that we focus on are anchors to hold us in those difficult times. And I hope today's verse will be the same for you. It was 25 years ago this October that I resigned from my former church in New Jersey. Few of you know of my story in that church. Probably most of you do not. But I was there a very short time. The first 2 years there at that church were very difficult years. I wasn't there but a few months when it became apparent and it was became evident that the chairman of the leadership board of the church, who was also the chairman of the pulpit committee that called me, was involved in an affair. In fact, he used the youth pastor's parsonage, because we didn't have a youth pastor at the time, for his rendezvous. Well, that obviously wasn't very good for the church, and it wasn't very helpful to me, because over the course of time, I think Sue and I have concluded that his failing led to a mistrust of me. After all, he was leading the committee that helped bring me as the pastor. Well, anyway, that first year was working through that, helping his wife. He ended up divorcing her and leaving, obviously, not just the church, but his family. And it was just an awful situation. Well, when we moved on from that chapter, the next year, there were people who in leadership who were frustrated with me. Primarily their frustration was with my preaching. And there's something, you know, when you get up to speak in front of people week after week, you're pretty vulnerable, whether you do it well or whether you do it poorly. And so, for some reason, a few of the deacons felt it was their responsibility to help straighten me out. The problem was, each of them didn't have the same thing in mind. I mean, one of them felt I was doing one thing wrong, another said it was another thing. And we ended up having several different leadership board meetings that went on for, seemed like hours and hours. But they're all focused on how do you fix Tory. And the leadership board meetings were bad enough, but Sunday mornings were the worst, because I knew as I got up to preach, I wasn't just preaching a sermon, I was being evaluated by each of these leaders. Well, it didn't get better. It became evident to me that what each of them was looking for was something different from one another and different from who I was. And so I finally felt it was the best thing for me to do if I just resigned. I'd only been there just a little over a couple years, but I thought this is going to be the best thing for the church. We just don't need to have this going on and on. And so I had it all planned out. I was very discouraged. Obviously, you don't resign from a church after a couple years of being there and feel good about it. But I had it planned out. This was in October, and I thought, I will resign in October. The church will give me probably till the end of the year, and then in the new year, I'll move on to another church, and they'll move on with finding another pastor. Well, I was pretty confident that when I tendered my resignation to the joint leadership boards, it was trustees and deacons in that church, I was pretty confident they were going to accept my resignation. What I didn't expect was how quickly they accepted it. I mean, I we met, I called the leadership meeting and I gave them my letter of resignation. They weren't expecting it, so they sent me home, which home was 100 yards away across a parking lot, and they met and they tried to figure out what they were going to do. And after a half hour or so, they called me back and they said, "We accept your resignation. You're done tonight. We don't want you, we want you to clean out your things in the morning and we don't want you back in the pulpit." It was not the way I'd scripted it. I had planned that we would have several months to say goodbye, several months for me to put out my resume, to start looking for another church. I had scripted it very differently. Instead, I was done. And the chairman of the trustee board said, "We don't ever want you back in this church again." So, needless to say, I was discouraged, I was devastated, and I was afraid. I had a young family at that time, and we hadn't made a whole lot of money up to that point, and so I found myself thinking, how are we going to make it? What are we going to do? I mean, I am now done, and I have to get a job, and you don't get a pastor right away. You don't get a pastorate right away. It takes months of working things through and getting to know a church and then getting to know you. And so I thought, this is going to be a long haul. At best, we're talking several months. At worst, a year or more. What are we going to do? Well, I remember going home. I don't know that it was that night, but I remember a time when Sue was out with the boys, and it's just me alone in our house. And I remember kneeling down by our green couch. Those of you who've been to our house, it's the same. It was new then, but it was the same couch there. And I remember just weeping and saying, "God, what's going to happen? How are we going to make it? I didn't even think God had a plan, and I just didn't know what I was going to do. So all I could do was to fall on my face before Him. Now, I tell you my story because I know I'm not alone. I mean, Yolanda shared her story, and all of us have those stories, whether it's a job that you lost, whether it's a relationship or a marriage that's gone bad, whether it's a financial upset in your life, whether you've gone to the doctor and you've gotten a diagnosis that you didn't expect. And now you're facing cancer or you're facing something else, and you're thinking, how am I going to face this? And you're afraid. What do you do? What do you do when you are afraid and you don't know what's going to happen next? Well, there's a psalm there's a number of psalms actually that we could turn to, but there's one that a verse jumped out at me as I thought about this topic. It's Psalm 56. If you have your Bibles, I'd encourage you to turn there. If you don't have your Bibles, you can listen along as I read mine. But I'll read you the psalm, but then I want to talk to you about it, because this psalm is a powerful message to us when we're afraid. It says, "For the director of music, to the tune of A Dove on Distant Oaks of David, a miktam, when the Philistines had seized him at Gath. Be merciful to me, O God, for men hotly pursue me. All day long they press their attack. My slanderers pursue me all day long. Many are attacking me in their pride. When I am afraid, I will trust in you. In God, whose word I praise, in God I trust, I will not be afraid. What can mortal man do to me? All day long they twist my words. They are always plotting to harm me. They conspire, they lurk, they watch my steps, eager to take my life. On no account let them escape. In your anger, O God, bring down the nations. Record the lament. Record my lament. List my tears in your scroll. Are they not on your record? Then my enemies will turn back when I call for help. By this, I will know that God is for me. In God, whose word I praise, and the Lord, whose word I praise, in God I trust, I will not be afraid. What can man do to me? I am under vows to you, O God. I will present my thank offerings to you. For you have delivered me from death and my feet from stumbling, that I may walk before God in the light of life. Now, to understand this psalm and to recognize what makes it so powerful, it's more than just how we relate to it, because there are certain psalms that just kind of grip us because you read them and you can so relate to that. And if you're like me, there are definitely verses in this psalm that grab you. But there's a part of the psalm that I read that you probably noted that I read that doesn't normally get read, and it's the superscription. And some of you may remember back from a couple years ago, we did a series in the Psalms, and one of the things that I said to you then that I'll remind you of now is the superscription of the Psalms is every bit as inspired as the rest of the Psalm. For some reason, God saw fit to include that when this Psalm was recorded. And in this case, the superscription gives us the backstory on this song. And so as you think about this, if I turn my thing on, there we go. The backstory is found for us in 1 Samuel 21, 10 through 15. Now, I will actually read the first few verses of that because it will be of some help to you, I think. But even the backstory needs the backstory. It says, that day, David fled from Saul and went to Achish, king of Gath. But the servants of Achish said to him, isn't this David the king of the land? Isn't he the one they sing about in their dances? Saul has slain his thousands and David his tens of thousands. David took these words to heart, and I underline this in my Bible, and was very much afraid. Now, I underline that because when you think about David, you think here's this little shepherd boy who went up against lions and bears and seemed fearless, and he faced a giant and he toppled him, and he seemed like a fearless person. And yet in this situation, David was scared spitless. Let me give you more of the backstory. The backstory goes back to a time when David, who was just a young teenager, too young to be conscripted into the Israeli army, volunteered to fight Goliath. My guess is that most of us know that part of the story. But after David fought Goliath, he gained notoriety. He not only fought Goliath, but if you remember, he helped lead the army to attack the Philistines and to rout them. And so when David came back from that and from other campaigns against the Philistines, the women in Israel, we are told, came out of their houses when their husbands came back from war. And they said, Saul slayed his thousands, but David slayed his 10,000s. I mean, he was famous. He was a hero. He was a warrior, even as a young man. But again, if whatever you remember of the story, David's success was also a problem because Saul, the king at the time, was jealous. Not only was Saul jealous, but the truth is, if you know the story around the slaying of Goliath, the person who should have gone to battle against Goliath was Saul. Saul, we're told, was the tallest man in Israel, and that's one of the reasons he was big. He looked the part of a king. But he was more afraid than anybody, and he wasn't going to fight Goliath. So he must have had some guilt over the fact that he sent David off to fight. And he must have obviously had some jealousy that when David fought, he was successful. And then when David fought, he gained the notoriety far more than the king. Anyway, Saul was jealous. And Saul himself was suspicious. Because Saul thought like a king who was trying to preserve his kingship. And he saw David as a threat to the throne. David didn't think that way, but Saul definitely did. And we're told that God allowed an evil spirit into Saul. So Saul, who had already in the course of things turned his back on God and shown that he really wasn't ready to follow God, and God had already anointed David to be the next king, but Saul didn't know that. Saul and everybody else were already seeing the greatness of this young man. And so with every success that David experienced, Saul gained greater fear, greater jealousy, greater anxiety. And one day, Saul just picked up a spear and two times tried to kill David. And that was just the beginning. After that, Saul would tell his men to try to find David and to kill him. My suspicions are, you don't just tell people to kill a hero. So my suspicions are Saul probably had a story to go along with it that he would tell the people so that those he sent felt they were doing the nation and the king a favor. I don't know that for a fact, but I just know that you don't kill a nation's hero if you think they're a hero. So my guess is that Saul probably had his own story, and he may have even believed his story to some extent. Anyway, things got so bad that Saul decided he was going to catch David in his own bed at home and kill him. But in the course of things, David had married. And the woman he married actually was given to him in marriage by Saul. It was his daughter. And because of her place, she got word of the fact that the king had plans to kill David. And so when they were on their way over to kill him, Michal said to David, "David, you got to get out of here. They're coming to kill you. Run." And they put some kind of a thing that looked like a body in his bed. So when they showed up, there was somebody there, but it wasn't David because he was on the road. And David escaped. Well, I tell you all that because where does a person run in Israel when the king of Israel is after them? There aren't too many safe places. So the first place, apparently, that David thought to run was a town called Gath. Now, does Gath ring a bell with anybody? Does that Gath is the hometown of Goliath. It was not an Israeli town. It was a Philistine town. So David felt, if I'm going to stay clear of Saul, the best place to do that is to go to the Philistine territory. Now you may say, why would David, who had killed his share of Philistines, why would he go there? Well, my guess is, you know, when you're in battle armor and certainly it was before cell phones and the internet, you could be pretty inconspicuous to a nation. Plus, going to a city, there's always people from foreigners in a city. So I think David thought, I'll stay clear of King Saul and I'll just hide out here in Gath. No one will ever think to find me. It was a great idea, except David had greater notoriety than he realized. As we read, when I read you that story, it said that that one of the king's servants recognized David. He said, isn't this David the king of the land? Now, he wasn't the king of the land, but he was going to be. I mean, you keep seeing this evidence that God had plans for David. And we know that because he'd already been anointed king. And notice, this is what the Philistines said. Isn't he the one that says, Saul has slain his thousands and David his tens of thousands? this refrain that made David famous in Israel made him infamous in Gath. I mean, that made him public enemy number one. And so all of a sudden, David has been found out. As far as we know, he had no friends, none of his fellow soldiers with him. He is there on his own. And 1 Samuel doesn't say this, but reading from the superscription in Psalm 56, it says, when the Philistines had seized him at Gath. So I think it's safe to assume that if this is that story, and I don't know another story when David is there at Gath, that the servants turned David in, and then they seized him, probably brought him to the king, and said, look who we have for you, king. And as they're telling the story, we're told, and David was very much afraid. It's not surprising. I mean, if anybody knew he was there, we're not aware of it. David was very much on his own. He had no other help. He was under the power of King Achish. He was hated by the Philistines, and everyone could just see what was going to happen to him. He was going to be executed. So if we stop the story right there, this is the backstory that leads us to this psalm. So if you read this psalm in that context, you can understand that this is a very palpable fear that David had. So he says, he cries out to God, be merciful to me, O God, for men hotly pursue me. All day long they press the attack. My slanderers pursue me all day long. Many are attacking me in their pride. Now, this psalm is written in a more general way than just to speak of David's own personal experience. But you can see David's experience in this. I mean, if Saul wanted David dead, clearly he and those who worked for him, they were pursuing him, and they had pursued him out of Israel, and now he's in the hands of a Philistine king who's likely to be no more gentle on him than Saul. And so he realizes that he's in deep weeds. I mean, it's a hopeless, helpless situation. But the question is, what do you do when you're fearful? What do you do when you're overwhelmed? And this psalm is the answer to that. And it certainly begins by just crying out to God, as David does, be merciful to me, O God. The one good thing about being in a hopeless, helpless situation is you don't have a lot of places to turn. And the thing that I found that was good about that back 25 years ago in my moment was I wanted to trust in my bank account, but that wasn't going to get us very far. I know I reached out to my parents, and they were an encouragement and support to me, and I really thought there was a good chance we were going to be moving in with them for a while. But ultimately, I realized those were not the people. They were not that wasn't going to be my solution. When I was crying at my sofa, crying out to God, I was where David was. I realized I needed God. And that's where David begins. But I love verses 3 and 4. And those are the verses, if you're memorizing verses, they're the verses I want to encourage you to memorize. He says, when I am afraid, I will trust in you, in God, whose word I praise. In God I trust. I will not be afraid. What can mortal men do to me? It's in verse 1, he says, be merciful to me, O God, for men. It's the same word. Men are hotly pursuing me. Now, these aren't just ordinary men. We've got the king of Israel after him. We've got the king of the Philistines after him. But David realized in that moment, the only one who could get him out of this mess was the king of heaven. And it was to him that he cried out, be merciful to me, O God. So what do you do when you're afraid? What did David do? When I am afraid, he says, I will trust in you, in God, whose word I praise. I'm not sure what word that is. Some commentators believe it was a specific promise that David was trusting in. Perhaps the very fact that he was anointed to be the king over Israel, and he knew Samuel had anointed him. So he must have had in the back of his mind, you know, if God really wants me to be king in Israel, I'm not going to die here in Gath. We may not have a word that specific for us, but we have quite a few words here. Some of the words that we're memorizing over the course of the summer are words that will help us when we're afraid. We put our trust in God, the one for whom we praise that word. As we do that, we have no reason to fear. So it was with David. But he goes on. We won't spend a lot of time in the rest of the psalm, but he goes on to spell out his concerns in verses 5 through 8. He says, all day long, they twist my words. They're always plotting to harm me. They conspire. They lurk. They watch my steps, eager to take my life. We know that was true with Saul and the people he had working for him. On no account, let them escape. In your anger, O God, bring down the nations. Bring down, it could be translated, bring down the nations or bring down the peoples. And that's where I think this psalm is so great. It's specific enough that we can see it applying to David's situation, but it's broad enough that we can see that it's a prayer we can pray for unjust nations and unjust rulers to ask for God's justice to be done. On account of them, I love verse 8. Record my lament. List my tears on your scroll. Are they not in your record? Now, this psalm has a few different translation issues that I'm not a Hebrew scholar, but there's some words that, and you may find this in a different translation that are translated differently. Even in the NIV, it says, put my tears in your wineskin. That's an alternative reading because it's a different text that's translated. And I kind of like that version. Put my tears in your wineskin, or put my tears in your bottle. One commentator speaking about that said, you think about a people who lived in a desert and where liquids, water was scarce. God collects tears and he puts them in a bottle. They're precious to him. So if you find yourself crying out to God, you think, God, what are you doing? What's happening to me? Realize that your tears are precious to him. your anguish, your fear matters to him, and he will do something about it. David understood that, and he says, God notices it. He takes record of it. Your struggles are not lost on God. And then he says, then my enemies will turn back when I call for help. By this I will know that God is for me. Then notice verses 10 and 11, because it's like David wants to make sure in this psalm we don't miss what he's trying to tell us. In God, whose word I praise, in the Lord, whose word I praise, in God I trust. I will not be afraid. What can man do to me? It's saying essentially the same thing in different words. What do you do when you're afraid? Put your trust in God. He says, I am under vows to you, O God. I will present my thank offerings to you, for you have delivered me from death and my feet from stumbling, that I may walk before God in the light of life. I don't know exactly when David wrote this psalm. I don't think we can say for sure. Did he write it after he was delivered? Or did he write it before he was delivered? I'm almost inclined to think he wrote it before he was delivered. And yet, he is trusting in God so that he ends the psalm with this praise for what God, he knows God will do. So, how did God deliver David? Well, this is a strange story, but the next verses tell us the answer. So when the king of Gath recognized who David was, it says, verse 13, so he, David, pretended to be insane in their presence. And while he was in their hands, he acted like a madman, making marks on the doors and the gate and letting saliva run down his beard. Achish, the king, said to his servants, look at that man. He's insane. Why bring him to me? Am I so short of madmen that you have to bring this fellow here to carry on like this in front of me? Must this man come into my house? Now, I don't know about you, but I think, what kind of acting job did it take to persuade Achish that enemy number one in my hands is truly insane? And I'm going to let him go. Well, there are a few different answers I've thought of. None of these are I can blame on commentator, just my insight. So that you can forget them if they're not worth much. But one, we know David was a talented person. We know he was a skillful singer, musician, leader. So it really didn't surprise me if he had some amazing acting talents to go along with that. That's point number one. But, I mean, put Tom Hanks there. Could he have confused the king to believe that he was so insane that the king would just say, I don't even want to mess with him? I don't know. That's some acting job. Point number two, David was in Gath. Why would any man in his right mind, who was an Israeli leader, they called him king, why would he be hanging out in Gath? Maybe the king thought anybody who's here in Gath in the first place has to be a little screwy. So perhaps that made a difference. Then it occurred to me that, remember, David had been called in to minister to Saul, who had an evil spirit. And that evil spirit really was a type of insanity. I mean, we already saw in the story how in one moment of rage, Saul picked up a spear and tried to kill David twice. later on, he even tried to kill his own son. So David had seen insanity up close. He had comforted and soothed one king who had at least a temporary form of insanity. So he'd been kind of practicing for this role without even knowing he was practicing for the role. And then the final thing that I'd point out is that in that day, insanity was seen as something from the gods. I mean, that was true. You see it even with Saul, because we're told that Saul was given an evil spirit from God. And so there was amongst some this thought of, I don't want anything to do if the gods are dealing with this kind of a superstitious, just keep that person away from me. Those are all human reasons why Achish bought what David was selling. But you and I ultimately know the ultimate answer. And that is because God was at work. God not only enabled David to give that job, the acting job of his life, he probably worked in Achish's mind to give him the Academy Award for it. God was clearly the one that David is trusting, not in his own. There's nothing in this where David's saying, I'm going to get out of this. And he saw there was no chance. And the point is, when you're afraid, trust God. Now, some of you may wonder, how did things go with me? I mean, I left you and I'd been lost my job at my church. Well, I'll give you a semi-short version, but as I waited to find out what the plan of the church board was for me, I didn't know if I was, I knew I wasn't supposed to come back there and to work there again. But turns out the church members were not happy with the church leaders and how they'd handled the situation with me. And so they insisted that the church leaders take care of us. And so the church leaders told me, we'll give you 6 months severance and you can stay in the parsonage. And so for 6 months, we had rent free, and our son Carrie, who was in first grade at that time, was able to get until April. That was the end of 6 months. As the end of 6 months came along, I knew I'd kind of been pushing it to stay as long as we had, but I went back to the leaders and I said, look, my son's finishing his first year in first grade, and I'd hate to pull him out of school. Is there a way that I could pay rent at the Parsons? You don't have a pastor coming, and I'll happily pay rent, and we'll stay through the end of the school year, and then we'll leave. Well, they sent me away and had their conference like they had done a couple times, and I don't remember if it was the next day or a couple days later, they called me back, and I can chuckle about it today. I don't know. I don't remember if I chuckled about it then, but they said, we don't want you here, but we think it would be give the church a bad reputation if we kicked you out on the street. So we're going to let you stay rent free until the end of the school year. I had no idea where we were going to stay. I had no idea how we were going to make ends meet. We had our housing provided. The church leaders, contrary to what they wanted to do, provided us with income. Also during that time, I preached in a few different churches, preached at Calvary Baptist in downtown New York and a few other churches. It ended up being a wonderful time. And I went to a church in Tarrytown and I filled the pulpit here. And God used that awful experience to lead me to the place where I would spend the majority of my life in ministry. What do you do when you're afraid? David tells us, when I am afraid, I trust in you, in God, whose word I praise. In God I trust. I will not be afraid. What can mortal man do to me? When we have a God like that, we have nothing to fear. Let's pray together. Oh Lord, I thank you that I can preach this message years down the road, seeing far more of it than I ever did years ago. Seeing that David and so many of my brothers and sisters whose stories I'm familiar with here in this church have faced their scary news from doctors, their news from employers, their news from spouses. Fearful news. Lord, help us. Help us to praise your word, to praise your name, to trust you. Thank you for this reminder. In Jesus' name, amen.